Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Barty in Washington. Today is Monday, October 23rd, and here are some of the stories we are covering. A UN relief agency welcomes the weekend opening of the Rafah border crossing, but says it is insufficient.
What we really need is for these convoys to come in on a daily basis for people in need in Gaza. What we also need, and equally critical, is for fuel to come into Gaza.
The U.S. boosts its military presence in the Middle East as a deterrent, and Lesotho security forces suspending democracy or protecting it. We'll have an analysis. Zambia's Minister of Information defends freedom of speech and movement in his country.
To describe Zambia as a police state is like you are describing another country and not Zambia. A police state is a country of lawlessness.
And a U.S. charity donates shoes that can expand to fit the foot sizes of Kenyan children. Those stories plus Samson O'Malley's sports are coming up on Daybreak Africa. The spokesperson for the United Nations Relief and Works Agency, also known as UNRWA, says its immediate goal is to allow unimpeded humanitarian access to Gaza and a humanitarian ceasefire to save children's lives. Juliet Tuma says her agency welcomes the weekend opening of the Rafah border crossing to allow some relief, but that it is not sufficient given the needs of the people of Gaza. She tells me that UNRWA also needs fuel to replace dwindling supplies, which are critical for the agency's work.
We welcome first humanitarian convoy since the siege was imposed on the Gaza Strip more than 2 weeks ago. It is far from enough. It is a drop in the ocean. What we really need is for these convoys to come in on a daily basis for people in need in Gaza. What we also need at the same time, and equally critical, is for fuel to come into Gaza, because UNRWA is running out of fuel in Gaza, and it is critical for the resumption of our humanitarian operation in the Gaza Strip.
So how would you describe the overall humanitarian situation in Gaza? In other words, what are your immediate needs?
Well, UNRWA is the largest humanitarian operator in the Gaza Strip, and we have 13,000 staff members working with us. Many are now very busy responding to the needs of people who have become displaced because of the war. We have more than 500,000 people taking shelter in our schools and other facilities. Their needs are huge. This is why it's absolutely fundamental that UNRWA gets in fuel to the Gaza Strip immediately so that we're able to respond to these increasing needs. They are increasing by the hour.
What does the continued fighting between Israeli forces and Hamas and the possibility of a ground invasion do to your carrying out your humanitarian work there?
You see, UNRWA has been on the ground as the largest humanitarian operator for more than 70 years. We have been there through thick and thin with the communities. Our staff continue to deliver assistance even as they themselves have been impacted. As we had at least 17 colleagues of mine who have sadly been killed since the war began. We had a lot of our staff members who lost loved ones, who lost neighbors and friends and relatives. They themselves have been displaced. They themselves have lost homes. So our staff have been impacted themselves. However, we have many who continue to be responsive and continue to be doing their humanitarian duty and providing humanitarian assistance to the degree possible to the communities in need.
Once again, what is your immediate wish as the conflict enters its second week?
Well, we have two. One is to allow humanitarian access, and for that humanitarian access, to allow UNRWA to bring in humanitarian supplies and other UN agencies. We are not alone in the field. We have many humanitarian agencies who work with us on the ground, that we are allowed in the UN to bring in humanitarian supplies on a regular basis, and that yesterday's convoy, while welcome, should not be a one-off. The second wish is to reiterate what the Secretary General of the UN has said and to reach a humanitarian ceasefire as soon as possible to spare the lives of civilians everywhere.
Juliet, thank you so much again. A pleasure speaking with you. Please be safe.
Thank you so much.
Juliet Tumal is the United Nations Relief and Works Agency spokesperson. She spoke with us from Amman, Jordan. As the Israel-Hamas war intensifies, the United States underscored Sunday that its military presence in the Middle East is being boosted as of now, but only as a deterrent measure. However, it also warned that it will swiftly respond to any imminent threat. VOA's Veronica Balderas Iglesias reports.
As Israeli forces prepare for the next stages of their war against the militant Palestinian group Hamas, concerns of it becoming a wider conflict haven't subsided. In that context, the United States announced additional deployments of air defense systems to the region. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin explained the move on ABC's This Week show.
Recently, we've seen rocket and UAV attacks against bases housing our troops in Iraq and Syria. We maintain the right to defend ourselves, and we won't hesitate to take the appropriate action.
Secretary of State Antony Blinken, who recently toured the region, emphasized that the boost in U.S. military presence is a deterrent measure. He was interviewed on NBC's Meet the Press.
We don't want to see a second or third front develop. We don't want to see our forces or our personnel come under fire. But if that happens, we're ready for it.
On the humanitarian front, Turkey became one of the latest countries to send aid for Palestinian civilians. But the flow of convoys carrying supplies across Egypt's Rafah crossing into Gaza has been too slow, said Cindy McCain, the executive director of the UN World Food Program, in an interview with ABC.
We were able to feed about 200,000 people last night during dinner. But that's not enough. That's a drop. People are starving, but also this is a national security issue for everyone in this region.
With the stakes so high in the Middle East, it's imperative that the Republican majority in the U.S. House of Representatives elect a speaker, said the chair of the Foreign Affairs Committee, Republican Michael McCaul. He spoke on ABC about the deadlock to fill the seat that has remained vacant since Kevin McCarthy was ousted at the beginning of October.
The world's on fire, and this is so dangerous what we're doing. And most importantly, it's embarrassing because it empowers and emboldens our adversaries.
Despite the urgency, McCaul acknowledged that he doesn't know if a speaker will be elected this coming week or how the process will play out. Veronica Valderas Iglesias, VOA News, Washington.
Zambia's Minister of Information says freedom of speech and press are vibrant under the government of President Hakainde Hichilema. However, Cornelius Mwitwa says the two are not carte blanche or without restrictions. His comment comes after Archbishop Emeritus Teresfori Mpondu last week warned of what he called emerging authoritarian tendencies under President Hichilema's government. The Archbishop said in a statement that Zambians are living in a police state where their freedom of assembly and association are at the mercy of the state police. He specifically cited as an example former President Edgar Lungu, who he said has no freedom of movement. Mwitwa tells me that the former president is a state asset who is monitored by the state for security reasons.
First of all, I think that the bishop is being too extravagant, linguistically extravagant in the way he has characterized and described the situation obtaining in Zambia. One, to say there is authoritarianism and dictatorship is not just a misnomer. It is malicious and highly misplaced and unsubstantiable claims emanating from vantages of individuals who may have had personal expectations that have been dashed. But that is not the way to express your frustrations. The truth of the matter is that what he is talking about on the ground does not exist. Zambia today, it's free again. To describe Zambia as a police state, it's like you are describing another country and not Zambia. A police state is a country of lawlessness. This is not what is happening in this country.
Can we zero in on some of the points that the bishop raised? He talked about the issue of freedom of movement. And in that, he gave the example of the former president, Edgar Lungu, who he said is constrictively imprisoned by the state because the former president, he said, cannot leave the country, cannot do anything without his movement being restricted.
Well, again, that is a typical example of misplaced argument on the part of the archbishop. Look, the former president was president, so he knows how former presidents move. The former president gets 80% of the emolument or salary of the current president. So de facto, a former president is not a private individual. This is a state property. Is a state asset, and therefore his movements are not restricted by the state. His movements are monitored by the state for the sake of providing security.
Before I let you go, the bishop makes comment about the government intimidating or trying to silence the private media in Zambia. He cites the example of Hot FM radio. What can you tell us?
Well, first of all, me, I'm the Minister for Information and Government spokesperson. I have no intentions whatsoever to silence the, you know, any media, whether public or private. The media is, you know, freely going about their businesses. The particular media house, as much as it is giving particular individuals freedom to speak, that freedom is not limitless. There is a requirement to realize that those who speak should be cognizant of the fact the people they speak about also have you know, freedoms that need to be respected. You should not be carte blanche because there is freedom to speak, so you can go and speak wantonly. But I can assure you as government spokesperson that there is nothing in the offing in the direction of silencing the media whatsoever. We have a very close working relationship with the media freedoms and press freedoms in Zambia are guaranteed and secure under the leadership of President HH.
Cornelius Mwitwa is the Zambia's information minister. He was speaking with me from the capital, Lusaka. You are listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Barton in Washington. Today is Monday, October 23rd. For more African news and features, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Connect with us on all social media platforms. We are on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. And still to come on our program, Samson O'Malley Sports. A year ago, Sam Matakane of the Revolution for Prosperity Party, the RFP, was elected Prime Minister of Lesotho. Last week, the country, noted for its political instability with frequent changes of governments, was at it again. 64 members of parliament sought to introduce a vote of no confidence in the prime minister, but before they could, an RFP member of parliament filed an injunction with the constitutional court to stop the motion until the completion of a national reform process. Key among the reforms is that a sitting prime minister can only be removed by a two-thirds majority vote in parliament instead of the current simple majority. In a surprising move, the country's security forces sealed off parliament to prevent the no-confidence vote from taking place. Professor Sipo Sipi is a former deputy vice-chancellor for institutional support at the University of Zululand. He tells me that the security forces are undermining the freedom of Basotho to express themselves through their parliament.
It's very unfortunate for the security forces to get into a political space. In a democratic constitutionalism, what we have is that the security forces serve the government of the day, and they allow the political process to take its course without interference. That is the fundamental issue. That's why it's called a constitutional crisis, because you have soldiers now participating and interfering in the political process. And what you have in Utu at the moment, you have a prime minister who is not really a politician. He's a businessman who has gone in there to say he's going to resolve issues that politicians are not able to do. But he has done so by getting into the political space. And when you're in the political space, you are expected to play the political game and follow the rules. Now, what you have with parliamentarians, whether they are pursuing selfish interest, is that they are not convinced that it's taking the SOTU in the right direction. And it may be that what they are pursuing are narrow interests. But you do not suspend democracy to promote democracy.
Professor, it was because of this, what I would call constant changes of government in Lesotho, that SADC came in and asked for a reform of the political system, particularly what it would take to introduce a vote of no confidence in the prime minister, which is two-thirds. Now, the prime minister is saying that he would like for that reform process to take place.
Yeah, but what he's actually saying, if he has confidence in himself, that motion should be defeated. Because ultimately, the people must be able to dictate. It cannot be SADC. SADC can make a suggestion to say, let us go this route, and we think this route is the best way. But now to suspend the right of the people through the parliamentary representatives to express themselves, it is now like having a country that is now ruled by SADC. I do think that sometimes people must be allowed to make their own mistakes and correct them. But as soon as we start having external supervision, then you're going to also create another instability where the people say the government that we have here is not the government of the people of Lesotho. It's the government of SADC.
So, Professor, let me ask you before I let you go. The introduction of the security forces, the police particularly, barring some members of parliament to even come to parliament, who is supposed to rein in the police?
Well, that is where the crisis comes in. Because what the police, what the security forces are doing, they are undermining the free expression of the will of the people through their parliamentary representative. And if that is allowed, there's nothing that suggests that this is a one time only. Effectively, if the security forces are not happy with something, then they're going to undermine the democratic process and undermine parliament. And this is something that should not be allowed, because we've seen the interventions of security forces in the rest of the continent, that once they're there, they then end up being removed by other security agencies. And then you start having military dictatorship repeating itself.
Professor Sipho Sipe is a political analyst and former deputy vice chancellor for institutional support at the University of Zululand. He was speaking with us from Johannesburg, South Africa. An estimated 20 million children in sub-Saharan Africa walk barefoot, leaving them vulnerable to diseases and parasites. A U.S. charity called Because International is donating to school children some specially designed shoes that expand five sizes and let and last for years. Juma Majanga reports from Nairobi's former settlements of Kibera, Kenya.
At Karama Academy Primary School in Africa's largest slum, Kenya's Kibra, children sing songs of joy. Thank you for giving us shoes, they sing in Swahili to celebrate a donation of special shoes from the American charity Because International in partnership with Swahiba Networks, a Kibra-based non-profit. Peter Abungu is the founder of Swahiba Networks.
The challenge in this particular area and some of the most impoverished parts of the nation is that most families' shoes is the last thing they think about. And so when a child is going to school, if they have probably some form of uniform, they will give the uniform, but the child will be barefoot.
Barefoot children are at heightened risk of stepping on sharp objects or being infected by harmful bacteria in soil or contaminated water. The shoe that grows, the name of the donated footwear, caters to the needs of growing children who live in poverty. As Japheth Opondo, Because International East Africa distribution partner, explains.
Kids grow very fast, and they tend to outgrow the normal shoes. That's why we came up with the shoe that grows. The shoe that grows is a special shoe that can adjust to different levels. So we target to give the child when it at its smallest size, and it can be adjusted as the foot grows at its biggest size.
Juliet Rispa is among the 200 Karama Academy students receiving a pair of the special shoes. The 13-year-old says she used to wear slippers to school.
I feel like I want to jump up around because it's super duper awesome and it's nice to wear new shoes.
RISPA's teacher, Tom Brand, thinks the shoes will help boost the students' confidence.
Some of them are the torn shoes since they come from the needy places. So it is of great help and I'm sure it will improve them even academically in that they'll be now have that self-confidence because they are decent from the shoes.
The World Health Organization says 1.5 billion people worldwide suffer from soil-transmitted helminths or parasitic worms, the highest number being in sub-Saharan Africa, where an estimated 20 million children walk without shoes due to high levels of poverty. Because International says it has distributed over 425,000 pairs of shoes in more than 100 countries, the United Nations Sustainable Development Goal number 1 calls for ending poverty in all its forms, everywhere. While a pair of shoes may not sound like much to some, for the children of Kibra, it means more self-confidence and better health. Juma Majanga, VOA News, Kibra, Kenya.
It's time now for Daybreak Africa Sports. Here is Samson Omale in Abuja, Nigeria. A very good Monday morning to you, Samson.
Good Monday morning to you too, James. We begin the sports in East Africa, where Burundi became the latest country to implement FIFA's Football for Schools program in a ceremony held at the Uranani Stadium in Buganda, outside Bujumbura, on Saturday. FIFA President Gianni Infantino, who attended the inauguration event, announced that Burundi is the 100th country to implement the project. The project aims to make the game more accessible to young people by incorporating football activities into the education system. Supported by UNESCO, it contributes to the education, development and empowerment of around 700 million children worldwide. Around 1.5 million footballs have been distributed since it was first launched in Puerto Rico in 2019, and more than 23 million children are using the Football for Schools app. And now to Morocco, where the North African country plans to build a large stadium in Beslemani near Casablanca and upgrade six others in preparations for co-hosting the 2030 World Cup. The Prime Minister's office has announced that a deal has been signed between the government and state-owned fund CDG to finance the new stadium to be ready by 2028 for a total cost of $500 million. The six stadiums to be renovated to host the Africa Cup of Nations in 2025 and the 2030 World Cup are in the cities of Agadir, Casablanca, Fez, Marrakech, Rabat and Tangier. Earlier this month, FIFA allocated the 2030 World Cup to Morocco, Spain and Portugal, but also said Uruguay, Argentina and Paraguay will host three matches to mark the tournament's centenary. Morocco will be the second African country to host the World Cup after South Africa in 2010. In mixed martial arts news, former welterweight champion Kamaru Usman of Nigeria suffered a third straight UFC defeat to unbeaten Khamzat Chimaev in the middleweight bout at the Etihad Arena in Abu Dhabi on Saturday. Chimaev successfully increased his undefeated record up to 13-0 with a majority decision win over the Nigerian at the UFC 294. Usman is now on a three-fight losing streak with two losses to Leon Edwards, but he had five consecutive title defenses at the welterweight leading to that point. In his post-match interview, Kamaru Usman wished his middleweight showdown against Khamzat Chimaev was five rounds and not three.
You know, it took me some time, but, you know, that's the difference. In a three-round fight, you can't start slow like that. You have to start. You know, it's not a five-rounder to where you have time to work yourself back in the fight. So that was my miscalculation.
And that's it for this Monday's edition of Daybreak Africa Sports. I am Samson Omale in Abuja, Nigeria. It's back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Samson. Have a good Monday. And that's it for this Monday, October 23rd edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for beginning your week with us. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa team, I am James Barty, Washington, wishing that you will have a great week.